In all of his parables, he always has elements that are common, everyday occurrences. This one's a little bit of an exception to that, and it raises our curiosity quite a bit. But Jesus also, in his parables, will have some sort of an exaggeration, something very unexpected, and it sometimes will result in a complete reversal to help emphasize something. Let's see if you can notice that as we begin reading in Luke 16, verse 19. And we'll read through verse 31. There was a rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who desired to be fed with what fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, even from the dogs came and licked his sores. Verse 22. The poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. And in Hades, being in torment, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham far off and Lazarus in his bosom. And he called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus to dip the end of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in anguish in this flame." But Abraham said, "Child, remember that you in your lifetime received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in anguish. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed, in order that those who would pass from here to you may not be able, and none may cross from there to us." And he said, "Then I beg you, Father, to send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, so that he may warn them, lest they also come into this place of torment." But Abraham said, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them." And he said, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent." And he said to them, "If they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced if someone should rise from the dead." And that's the end of the chapter, the end of the story. We have lots of questions about this Hadean realm that is brought up here. But I want to challenge you tonight to think about, what is the main point of this parable? Now, we would like to know, what happens after we die? Where do we go? And what this passage and others seem to suggest to us is that our fate is sealed upon death. It's not like God is in heaven saying, "All right, I'm going to have to wait to figure out who's going to heaven and who's not." And then on the great judgment day, he'll open the book of life and tally up all the good and all the bad. And depending on where you are determined there, he'll make his decision. We understand that a single sin that stains our soul will prevent us from going into heaven. Judgment day is when our judgment is pronounced, when God officially says where we will spend eternity. And he may very well say, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter in the joys that have been prepared by your master for you." Or he may very well say, "I never knew you. Depart from me." In the case of the rich man, he didn't hear those favorable words. He is in the Hadean realm. And he is in torment. The King James renders this word Hades as hell. And so this idea that he has gone to the final place of judgment, but it's not. It's some sort of place for the dead. That's what this term means. It's very much equivalent to the Hebrew term sheol, the grave, the place where the dead go and wait until judgment. And there's no reversal. There's no possibility of change. When Abraham says there's this chasm that separates us, there's nothing that can be done to change your status. There's not going to be any comfort that comes your way. His fate was sealed the moment he died. And in his life, he had so many pleasures and riches. And now, he's in torment. And Lazarus, Lazarus is enjoying all the greatness of this realm where he is. Jesus picks a name, Lazarus. That is curious. He doesn't always name people in his parables, in his stories. And Lazarus is the Greek form of the Hebrew name Eliezer, which means God is my help. And so I wonder if Jesus has purposely done that to suggest that the one who's going to help Lazarus is God. But it should have been this rich man who every day saw Lazarus there being laid out before him. And he was so weak being under the table of this man that he couldn't even compete with the dogs that were eating up the scraps. This was unbelievably a weak man. And this rich man had no use for helping him. Now, looking at the context of Luke 16, I want to mention to you, in verse 1, Jesus tells a parable. Again, it's not called a parable there, but we understand that to be because it's a story with physical attributes, a man and his situation, and it has a spiritual meaning that he applies. So it says, there was a rich man, and then in verse 19, the story we just read, there was a rich man. Jesus is focusing on the rich here in Luke 16. And in the middle, in verse 14, you have the Pharisees being described as people who were lovers of money. And when they heard the first story that we haven't read tonight, the parable of the unjust steward, when they heard that, they ridiculed him and said to them, and then he said to them, you are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts. For what is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God. In the first century world, they had the idea that if you were rich, obviously then, God was blessing you. He was pleased with you. Why else would you be rich? Why else would you have so much? And then there are other people who are destitute. They aren't looked upon favorably by God. Obviously, they're sinners. And that, I think, is probably a concept we in many ways have today as well. It's kind of crept into our way of thinking. It's just natural. We look at the outward appearance. God looks at the heart. And in the case of the Pharisees, Jesus is not responding well to their ridicule. He says, actually, you need to understand something. You're the ones who are spiritually destitute. And then he tells this parable about a reversal. I want you to stray over with me for just a moment to Deuteronomy 15. What should this rich man have done for this poor, very, very oppressed man, Lazarus? Well, you just look at a few verses here. Deuteronomy 15, verse 7, the law of Moses says, if among you one of your brothers should become poor in any of your towns within your land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your hearts or shut your hand against your poor brother. Verse 8, but you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, whatever that may be. Look at verse 10. You shall give to him freely, and your heart shall not be grudging when you give to him. Because for this, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in all that you undertake. Do not cease to help the poor, is what God says in these verses. In the mindset of the Pharisees, those are evil people. Why should I help them? Because I'm so good and God has blessed me. That's why the book of Job scares us so much. Job's three friends were terrified at the prospect that if Job were in fact a righteous man, and yet all these bad circumstances came and upon him, that means it could happen to me too. It'd be so much easier to say, oh well, that happened to Job because he's a bad guy. But that's not how the book unfolds. Bad things happen to good people. And we sing that song, farther along, we'll understand it. Farther along, we'll understand why. Cheer up, my brother. Live in the sunshine. We'll understand it all by and by. Why are the rich, evil rich, blessed so much? Life's not fair. Here I am trying to serve the Lord, and I have every if I didn't have bad luck, I wouldn't have any luck at all. Two steps forward and three steps back. Well, for this rich man, everything has been turned on its head. And it's permanent. There's no changing this. And so what I'd like to do in the few minutes that we have left is make two or three observations based on this parable here in Luke 16. I want you to observe with me, first of all, what we see in verse 23 is that this man lifts up his eyes, and what he has is clearness of sight. He is able to see for the first time through the eyes of God. He lived every day sumptuously. He was the king of the hill. And here was this man at the bottom, and he had no regard for him, despite what the law said. The metaphor of opening eyes is used throughout the Bible. I remember Jesus being quoted in Acts 26 by the Apostle Paul, and he says that he has sent Paul to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light. Paul, in other places, writes to the Ephesians, the Philippians. He says, I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened. This is a great opportunity for us who are still on this side of eternity to begin to see from God's perspective. A passage we are eminently familiar with is James 4 that talks about the brevity of life. We need to appreciate that. We need to recognize that we are not promised tomorrow. And there are those of us in this audience who have spent a night or two or a week in the hospital thinking this could be it. And by God's grace, you came out all right. But James says, there's no guarantee of that whatsoever. Verse 13, come now you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. And you know what he goes on to say. We should live our lives with this mantra: if the Lord wills. And I don't think that James is telling us that every time we speak, we have to say, well, if the Lord wills, I'm going to see you there. Or if the Lord wills, I'll go do this or that. And a lot of times you hear that language, and I like that language, where our brothers and sisters will talk to each other in that way: if the Lord wills. But every statement we make, we should have that mindset, because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We're just like a flower that appears for a little time, it's beautiful, and then no sooner has it come up that it just falls down and is withered away. That's also from James, James chapter 1. What is your life? It is but a vapor that appears for a little while, and then it's gone. I want you to turn with me to Psalm 73 for just a moment. Here's another familiar passage. I love this psalm of Asaph, and he is sick, physically ill, and he's very upset, I would really say depressed about it, and he raises this question with God: why is it that I'm sitting here having such a hard time, and there are other people who are in perfect health, and they're sinners, they're wealthy, and everything just going great for them? And he says, well, I was really having trouble with this. Verse 15, if I had said, I will speak thus, I would have betrayed the generation of your children. But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task. Here it is. Until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discerned their end. Truly you set them in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors. And we'll stop there. Asaph needed a change in perspective. He needed to be able to see life in terms of eternity. The present sufferings of this life are not worthy to be compared, as Paul would say in Romans 8:28. Not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us, to us. Life isn't fair. But we need this perspective. We need to be able to see with our own eyes just how serious living a righteous life is. Because one day, it'll be too late. And so right now, we may be very much needing a new perspective. We need to see things as they truly are. Because the rich man, it was too late for him. Secondly, take a look with me in verse number 25 again. And what we see is that this rich man now suddenly has consciousness of sin. Consciousness of sin. So he's not understanding why Lazarus can't just come over and dip his finger in some cool water and just, and we think how ridiculous that is. I mean, what good is that going to do you? He just wants a little bit of relief from his torment. But Abraham tells him in verse 25, "Child, remember that you in your lifetime received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner bad things. Now he is comforted here, and you are in anguish." How many times have we quoted that verse? "It is appointed unto man once to die, and after this the judgment." We all know it's true, but yet we hold death at bay. And we live our lives as if there is no end. But we need to think very soberly with that clearness of sight we have and be very much aware of what sin is. We don't, though. Especially since we are the rich man. In our society today, many of us, I suppose, would be middle class, maybe upper or lower middle class. But by the world standards, as you well know, you are rich. This rich man in Luke 16, he didn't have air conditioning. He didn't have cable TV. He didn't have an iPhone. Well, he may have had an iPhone, actually, being so rich. Think of all the luxuries that we have, that we take for granted. And we get very comfortable with life here right now. And we forget that we are just transitory beings. We're not meant to be here forever. And we become more and more enamored with the world. And eventually we get to the point that we just want to rush headlong into sin, as long as we don't get caught. But the fact is, God always knows. God always knows what's going on in your heart. Just like he did in the case of the Pharisees, he said, God knows your heart. And God also knows that sin is going to have detrimental effects on you. That's why he doesn't want you to commit sin. He desperately wants us to be conformed to the image of Christ so that we part ways with sin and we don't live like that anymore. Because all it's going to do is hurt us, destroy us, ravage us. I think of a couple of examples. Here's a rich man in Luke 12. And I'll just mention this as part of this parable of the rich fool, a man who thought he had all the time in the world. And so he tears down his barns and builds bigger because he had a bumper crop. What am I going to do with all this? Give it away? No. He's going to save it for retirement. And so he says, "I'm going to say to my soul, soul, you have many goods for many years. Let's sit back and relax. Eat, drink, and be merry." Problem is, that's not the end of the story. There's the judgment. And God judged that man, that rich fool, as he is called. There's another parable. That's a parable in Luke 15. I'll just mention this. There's this parable that is directed toward the Pharisees, just like the parable in Luke 16 is. And in Luke 15, Jesus is talking through the older brother, the one who didn't run off and waste his father's goods. And so he complains to the father, and I'm assuming that you are somewhat familiar with this context, but it says that in verse 27, the father says, "Well, we had to rejoice because your brother was dead." And so it's reported to the older brother, "Your brother has come, your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound." The brother's response was he was angry. Verse 29, he says to his father, "Look, these many years I have served you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I may make merry with my friends. And he continues to deride his younger brother rather than rejoicing that he has, in fact, come home. What is Jesus' point? There are those who think they are righteous because they're rich, they're successful, they're just full of pride, and yet they are spiritually destitute. The older brother says, I've never disobeyed one of your commands. Oh, really? We're all sinners, every last one of us. The younger brother was saved by grace. The older brother needed to be saved by grace. But for some reason he had in his mind, he was too good to be condemned. It's a powerful, powerful parable. It's a reversal where Jesus turns the tables on this older brother and points the accusing finger at the Pharisees, who trusted in themselves that they were righteous, as it says in the opening verses of Luke 15. And so Jesus is trying to get us to open our eyes to see how horrible sin is and how it can absolutely ravage our lives, not just here right now. And it may be that this young man, we'll talk about the young man for a moment, he ended up feeding pigs. And that's the moment when he came to himself. Sometimes the question's asked, what if he had been living high on the hog? What if everything had been fantastic in his life? Would then he have come back to the Father? Where are you spiritually? Are you thinking to yourself, I'm a good guy, I'm fine, and no one knows about my sin? You need to see from the perspective of this rich man. Sin will destroy you. Maybe not in this life, but most certainly in the life to come. I want to read one more verse along this line. And it was in Isaiah 1 verse 15. And here is a scathing indictment from God upon his people. He says to them in the opening chapter in Isaiah 1, He's condemning them in a courtroom scene, as it were. And he's telling them that I'm not blessing you. I'm not going to help you in your current distress. Why? When you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen to you. Listen to this. Your hands are full of blood. It's as if they're raising their hands up to God to pray to him, to beseech him. And their hands are just dripping with shed blood. And God says, I'm not going to listen to that. You don't realize how your sin has completely messed you up spiritually. Because nobody else knows. We think we've got it hidden, but it affects you. It affects every facet of your life. This rich man became so callous toward others in need. All he could think about was himself. We live in the me generation. We're very selfish and self-centered. And I wonder if Jesus, if he were here, would be telling this parable to me. I've been through Houston many a time, and there's some fellow there begging. He's got a sign. One guy said his excuse for why he's homeless: my wife had the better lawyer. That's supposed to motivate us then to help him out because he's got a cute sign. I don't give to those folks because, for one thing, they're ubiquitous. I mean, every street corner, there they are. But two, I don't want to be enabling them, and that's what I believe people are doing. But there are those who are in need. What are we going to do? Are we going to turn away from them? In this church, we often help our brothers and sisters, and I know that behind the scenes, many are helping others. It matters. Eternity is in the balance. We are going to be judged based on how we treat others in the life to come. That's what Jesus is telling us. And thirdly and finally, this evening. I want us to observe that this rich man suddenly becomes concerned for other sinners. And so he says to Jesus, I need you to send Lazarus. You send Lazarus and send him to my brothers. And for whatever reason, he does not want them to come to this place of torment. And what is the response? What does Abraham say? He says, sorry, that's not going to happen. That's not how it works. And he says, no. If somebody could just rise from the dead. And of course, we see the irony there because Jesus did rise from the dead and people still did not believe. You need to go back to Deuteronomy 15 and read the Law and the Prophets. I want to challenge us this week to change our perspective about sin, about ourselves, and also have this concern. And I know you do, but let's really work on our concern for the souls of others. Jesus, in John chapter 4, was very tired and weary from his journey. And we're told in verse number 6 that he was at Jacob's well. He was weary, sitting beside the well. And then a woman from Samaria came to draw water. And what Jesus did is he began to talk to her. His apostles went off to get food. And there's Jesus talking to this woman. And have you ever been really hungry and your blood sugar low and you're feeling kind of bad, but then something excites you? Something comes along that gets your attention and you forget all about your hunger. And that's what happens to Jesus. He's so excited about talking to this woman who responds well to him. And then the apostles come back to him in verse 31 and they say, Rabbi, we got food for you. Here, eat. And he said to them, I have food to eat that you do not know about. And then the disciples start thinking literally, somebody went to McDonald's and got him a Happy Meal or something. No, Jesus was talking about the excitement that he feels talking to this woman about the gospel. And then, perhaps as many of the Samaritans were coming toward them, Jesus looks and he sees these white garments that they're wearing. That's what I suppose is going on here in verse 35. And he tells his apostles, lift up your eyes and see that there is this great harvest. The fields are white for harvest. And I know it's discouraging. I know it's disappointing when you invite somebody to services and they don't come. But I want to challenge you this week to write down 5 names of people that you want to encourage to attend our assembly, to change our perspective and begin to reach out to somebody who needs our help and our encouragement. And I say write those names down because that'll help you keep yourself accountable, to actually look and see someone with their name written down that you're going to help. Many of you already do that, but I'd like to encourage us all to consider doing that this week. This man's perspective changed, but for him it was too late. He learned these lessons from Hades too late. As we close tonight, I want to extend an invitation to someone who knows they're not right with God. Maybe you've never become a Christian yet. You need to be baptized for the remission of your sins. We can help you with that tonight, right now. The baptistry is ready. Sometimes I get a text from Ray and he says, baptistry's empty. And then he'll say, baptistry's full. It's full. It's warm. It's ready to go. We would love to assist you in clothing you with Christ tonight. If you've been like this rich man, not caring about sin, not caring about the needs of others, let's repent of that. Let's change our hearts and live for the Lord. If we can help you, please make your way to the front right now. Let's stand. Let's sing.